Inside the Cross Podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome back to another episode of the Inside Lacrosse D1 Men's Lacrosse Podcast with your host Dan Flynn and my man, the incomparable Terry Foy.
So Dan, you talked about wanting to make the energy level higher this week than last week. Do you feel like you hit the target with that introduction?
I'm not sure, but I'm fired up today. We have a lot to talk about, a lot to get to, so much that we may even put something of very news and noteworthy off to another podcast.
So you're saying we have too much for one podcast. We have too much to talk about. One podcast is not enough.
But it was an exciting week. Terry, this is always...
You know what that reminds me of? What? So it was an exciting week of college lacrosse action. There's no question about it. But it's almost as if people have too much partying to put into one day on St. Patrick's Day. So shout out to my man Jeff Shannon for dubbing, at least the first time I saw it, St. Patrick's Month, which we are really in the throes of, having celebrated the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Baltimore yesterday, Sunday.
You went to that, right?
Which I attended.
How was it?
It was rainy.
Yeah.
It was wet. It felt authentic. but we are still 4 days away from celebrating St. Patrick's driving the snakes out of Ireland. Two Irish gents right here. I can assure you that we're going to take full advantage of that.
I took advantage of a Sunday afternoon with a big lacrosse game coming up to do the corned beef and cabbage yesterday.
Oh, yeah?
And the potatoes and the carrots. It was great. A traditional boiled dinner at the Flynn house.
How do you feel about the way that, for lack of a better term, stinks up your house?
It smells great, I think. Define stink.
I think corned beef is very aromatic.
But meat cooking all day.
No, it is the best.
Smells great. And, I had the same thing, every time I'm eating that, because it's so good. It's, like, fatty and salty, and everything just comes together in one big flavor. It's delicious. It's like Thanksgiving. Like, why do I only do that once a year? Why don't I do that? And it's pretty easy to cook.
So easy to prepare. We were talking about that yesterday.
I mean, I get the turkey, cooking a turkey, and all the other stuff is tough, but, God, it's so good, and I'm going to have to start doing it. I'm going to have to celebrate, like, a half St. Patrick's Day. That some people do, you know, like Guinness has that clock.
September 17th.
And I'm going to have to just throw down some corned beef. It's on the calendar for twice a year.
So are you, in terms of your attire, because I put a fair amount of thought into my outfit on a yearly basis when I get ready to go to the St. Patrick's Day parade party. And I always straddle the line between the obnoxious green and orange, which I don't really wear orange, versus trying to look like an authentic Irishman, because I feel like those are the two approaches that you can take. For example, there was a big bar crawl in my neighborhood on Saturday, and I saw a guy wearing a Dante Culpepper Miami Dolphins jersey. Yeah, that's... No, that's not
his Irish. Coach, George O'Leary, was Irish? I don't even... In college? That's not Irish at all, no.
New York Jets jerseys, how do you feel about that?
I saw a guy wearing a Jets 24 jersey just on the street last...
Did it have the Revis nameplate on it?
I don't know. It was so out of place. I was driving to work last week. And I just couldn't believe that I saw a man walking down the street wearing that.
Maybe it was Darrell Revis.
It was. He was too old. He was too old.
Not nearly fast enough.
No.
You know Darrell Revis is pretty old at this point.
He's no Daryl Green. Back to our Irish and green. So I just wear green. That's my move. I don't go over the top. Sometimes I'd like to dress like a St. Patrick. You know, put on the robes and all the... Get the
sandals,
shillelagh out.
Yeah.
But no, I just
Crozier.
I just throw some green on. Throw on the old Jimmy Flynn for state senate shirt when my dad was running for state senate. Or something like that, that gives me some secondary rep.
I had a couple of people make comments to the effect this week that essentially justified the decision that I made to do this podcast with you. I was like, people don't understand how many layers there are to Dan Flynn. Your dad ran for Delaware State Senate?
Yeah. Yeah,
twice. He could have been Joe Biden.
Well, okay. Hold on. There's the U.S. Senate.
I passed civics.
And then there's the state senate, which, you know, is a different thing. But my brother, my oldest brother's best friend, is our fair senator from from Delaware. Chris Coons is the U.S. senator, one of our 100 senators. And
hey, we're not getting political on this show.
No, I just think it's cool. Like, my brother's best friend, who I've spent some good time with in my life, is a real live U.S. senator.
Yeah, it's something that every mother dreams of her son being able to say, my son's friend is a senator. So, Dan, despite the, you know, St. Patrick's Day parade highlight that Sunday produced, when we reflect on Sunday, March 13th, 2016, there are a couple other things that we're going to remember. The NCAA bracket was released.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is one of the best days of the year. It's one of those days where I just kind of want to lock myself in a room and read all day long, you know, look at the bracket, pick your thing. And then there's also the lacrosse stuff. And then as weeks go, it also has St. Patrick's Day. So it feels like it should be like a month-long celebration.
I mean, St. Patrick's Day combined with the first day of March Madness is really the seven-year storm.
And daylight savings time. Oh. Love when it gets lighter. The days are a little bit longer. It is, I'm excited. And also, this time of year, I want to send a birthday shout-out to one of our listeners, George Gianfricaro. Well, probably when he listens to this, it will be his birthday on Tuesday. Also, all-star inside lacrosse intern who will be coming back this summer to wreak havoc at our summer events.
I'm sure that there are many, many other folks that are associated with this podcast who have birthdays in this very, you know, kind of realm of time, and we're going to forget all of them.
Perhaps. But yeah, big week. Lots of things to talk about. And I don't... The bracket. You want to just talk about a little NCAA hoop stuff before we move on?
No. Well, this is the part of the show where you take over, because I did not watch a minute of the selection show, and it sounds like that decision was completely vindicated. And I actually haven't even looked
Twitter
at the bracket.
Twitter was on fire.
Okay, so this is what I did. When the bracket got leaked, I downloaded it and then just tweeted it out, and I was like, hey, guys, now you can not look at this and just pay attention to lacrosse.
So I follow a lot of college basketball analysts, fans, bloggers of different schools, mostly in the ACC and locally, Terps, GW, Patrick Stevens. So there were people who were just destroying CBS's broadcast. It used to be a half-hour show, and it was incredible, lots of drama, who got in, who didn't, who got the top seeds, what are the big matchups. They drew it out to 2 hours, and they got killed for it. It was terrible. They were doing a bracket every half hour. And then I love when they drum out Kenny Smith and Charles Barkley, who have watched zero college basketball all season, and CBS brings them out for the NCAA tournament. And it shows when they really don't know what they're talking about.
So my favorite manifestation of that each year is when there's a difficult to pronounce player's last name that pretty much everybody that watches college basketball knows, but Charles Barkley does not. Who do you think, do you have a candidate or an idea in mind for who that might be this year?
It's too numerous. He butchers.
There's no like Tyler Zoller.
My favorite thing is I just like to see if Charles is wearing shorts or socks or shoes, because I know that he does that show sometimes in just a suit, tie, jacket, and then he'll just have shorts on underneath the table. But he was dressed up yesterday. But
good for Chuck.
Yeah, there were some seeding issues. Some people weren't happy with the way the Terps got a 5 seed. Some people thought that they could be earlier in the season a 1 seed or a 2 seed. No, they weren't happy about that. Oregon got a 1 seed, but probably deserving based on their record and their RPI and their BPI, which is ESPN's metric. So it was, without a doubt, an interesting night. But the brackets did get leaked, and CBS, the overnight ratings, Terry, worst show that they've done in 20 years in terms of ratings on that. And I hope the two-hour drawn-out experiment is enough to make them rethink that and change it when they go to do it next
year. Well, you know why nobody was watching.
They were watching lacrosse, Terry.
Absolutely, 1 versus 2. But we're gonna put that off for a sec because we got more to get to.
But there was a lot of ESPN, you know, such a big week media-wise for the sport, and a great ESPN was a winner this week in terms of just what they provided lacrosse fans. You could be objective about how they did it or the content that was, but I loved it. 3 games on Saturday on TV, yesterday's game, and then using the lead-in of the bracket selection show for the 30 for 30 documentary. I can't wait to see what the ratings are for that. I know that some of my friends who aren't big lacrosse fans were definitely talking about it. So there is a conversation that is going on all over the country, and whether you're a lacrosse fan or not. It's water cooler talk for sure.
Absolutely. But before we get into the games, and you know, we'll be going over in more individualized detail a lot of the games that were televised, let's talk about some of the news and notes from the lacrosse week. High school lacrosse got underway in earnest, and you know, that included, obviously, we've been going down south for, you know, more than a month at this point, but the Brian King of Spring tournament in Raleigh, North Carolina, where there were a lot of folks in attendance and some interesting outcomes. To me, McDonough beating Gonzaga in D.C. Early last week was the biggest result, biggest takeaway from the weekend. You have any thoughts on high school action?
It's just two top 10 teams from our Under Armour Inside Lacrosse top 25 power rankings. McDonough came in number 8. Gonzaga, number 5. Both teams expected to have great seasons. McDonough was in the championship game of the MIA lacrosse championships last year, bringing back a lot of talent. And McDonough gets a good win against the Purple Eagles.
That's right, the Purps.
And we had, I think, Dan Abram was down there covering that
one. He was in attendance, yeah, absolutely. That game was available to be seen on LAC Sports Network. Ty Zanders on the call, shout out. But moving on from the high school action, last week we talked about the ML All-Star game taking place at Cal State Fullerton. I butchered my Southern California geography. Thanks for the lifeline on that one. How familiar are you with Southern California?
Fairly decent.
Okay, well then you should have picked up on the fact that I was talking about Irvine when I thought I was talking about Fullerton.
I just didn't know where that stadium was.
Riverside? Yeah, I don't know either. Anyhow, this past week, the MLL announced that their semifinals will be taking place in Minnesota and at Fairfield University on the beach in Connecticut. Any thoughts on those two?
Yeah, so the same weekend, right?
Yeah.
And they'll just, two teams just get sent to Minnesota and two teams will just be in Fairfield.
Yep.
Will they do it arbitrarily? Is it sort of supposed to be neutrality? So what if it's like, you know, the local teams?
No, I'm sure that they'll assign ahead of time, you know, the 1-4 matchup is going to Minnesota, okay. The 2-3 matchup is going to Fairfield.
I think it's cool. You know, they're trying to grow the game. Putting marquee matchups in different neutral sites is cool. It's, you know, I'm thinking that they're looking to put a franchise in Minnesota soon.
Probably pretty clear on that one.
And I think it's great for the fans. It puts those guys are the best players in the world. They really are. And they're fun to watch. I don't know why more people don't watch them. It's played at such a high level. It's exciting. I think it's just going to take time. It's, you know, what do those rivalries mean? It's hard for teams to get behind.
Hard for fans to get behind teams that they don't have an attachment to.
Yeah, exactly. But I do think that it's a growing thing, and it'll just take time. But I'm excited about it. Moving on to that, and a relevant point in the next news and note, is an example of how a fan base that grows over time can build up a relationship with a team and a player.
Dan, you just destroyed that segue in every possible positive way. So John Tavares retired over the offseason, not immediately following the 2015 NHL season, and he's still with the Bandits in a bench capacity. But he was honored this past weekend with a video tribute in the stadium that it was 4 minutes long. It was posted on Twitter, made a lot of social media headway, and it was awesome. Over the course of the last week, you and I have discussed trying to create a landing page for this podcast so that all of this different types of multimedia content we discuss can be readily accessible. This video is going to be the reason that it's going to be what gets me over the hump in creating a podcast page for this weekend, because people need to be able to see this video, and they shouldn't have to scour the internet in order to find it.
Yeah, it was fantastic, and you know, I don't follow indoor lacrosse that much. I know how great of a player he was, but that video literally, it was extremely well done and well produced and thought out before, you know, they put it together, and it gave me goosebumps. I mean, it was really cool.
What'd you think about the Rex Ryan appearance toward the end?
Well, it was funny because I didn't recognize a lot of the people, and I'm like, what's Rex Ryan's in there? Just kind of like pops in.
The mayor of Buffalo.
Yeah.
B-Town.
It looks like they caught him in between, like he was like coming off a treadmill or something. Looked like he was working out. And they're like, hey, coach, you want to just say this about? And he's, who is it? And okay, yeah. Oh, he was a great player? Because I think like great people, coaches.
Great. Real recognize real. Is that what you're trying
exactly.
to say?
Exactly. And I think that they understand and respect what a legendary career is. And it was really cool to see that. Very much so. So me creating all the links and putting some of that stuff together last week didn't push you over the hump?
No, I started. I just didn't get it finished.
Okay, okay. So this is the week that I think you guys will start to see it. And maybe we can go back.
Oh,
and...
yeah, we're definitely backdating.
Okay.
That's part of why it's such a Herculean task.
Because
whenever you try to do something that's like drawn out over 6 weeks and condense it into like a two-day effort, it's going to be difficult.
Because I found what I thought was almost the spot-on picture of Coach Taylor from the Dillon Panthers and your guy who's the coach of Tottenham.
Who was about to become the coach of Tottenham for an additional 3 years, by the way.
Well, you got to be happy about that.
I certainly am. I don't know if Manchester United fans are very happy
about
it.
And the fact that you didn't post that, my picture comparison, I was a little disappointed. But you guys will see it at some point. Another news and note.
There was a community college?
Yeah. A 107-game win streak snapped by Nassau over the weekend.
It was an incredible feat. I mean, there's no question. Talking to George Powers in the wake of the Lions' win on Saturday evening, he made the comment that he's talked time and time again to Chuck Wilbur, who's the coach of OCC, about how positive that streak was in bringing attention to junior college lacrosse, junior college athletics. And there's no question. The Lasers' dominance, you know, they're 7 times national champions, is really, really remarkable. This sounded like a game where... OCC got up early. They were up 4-0 in the first quarter. I believe they extended their lead. They were up 5-4 at halftime, which means that Nassau really battled back. And to hear Coach Powers tell it, at that point in the locker room, his team believed that they could win, and that was the difference. That was, you know, kind of the crescendo moment. They came out and shut out OCC in the third quarter, took a commanding lead. I believe they were up 9-5 heading into the fourth. Of course, the Lasers made a run, as you would expect any great team to do, but getting a stop inside of a minute, clearing the ball, calling timeout, and then setting up a game-winning goal, midi ISOing and inverting and running off the pick for a slam dunk. You know, that was what it took to hand Onondaga Community College its first loss in more than 1,000 days.
I'm not that surprised that Nassau, a program with its rich history, you know, Coach Speckman is getting into the IMLCA Hall of Fame, and reading his accomplishments are staggering. But I'm not surprised that they won. It's the 107 games in a row. That's amazing that you can get up repeatedly when you always have sort of that target on your back. Everybody's trying to beat you. And just on a consistent basis, that well, win that. It's we've seen some amazing streaks in lacrosse. I think McDonough's girls team currently has something going on.
They're
like
in that. They're in that neighborhood as well.
It's amazing. It really is. And it's not like McDonough is playing competition, or they're not seeking great competition. They're playing incredible girls lacrosse competition on a regular basis, and they're unbeatable. That was fantastic. And getting into another story that has fantastic lies, Terry. I like that segue.
That was not crushed nearly as thoroughly as the previous segue.
But there was a documentary that ESPN showed last night that had a lot of build up and hype. We had heard from Quint weeks ago that he had seen an early copy of it, and he said it was tremendous. We'll get into this again. There's too much to talk about in this, and the history of this story, its history with Inside Lacrosse, what the role media plays in this, or just in news in general. We're thinking about doing a separate podcast about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it can, you know, in the same way that this was a two-hour documentary about an event that happened 10 years ago, I think we can have a 30-minute conversation about a show that aired 2 days ago that I expect will be very, very well watched.
Yeah, so we were thinking maybe doing a podcast about that topic later this week, and then maybe talking about some of the midweek games and previewing the weekend later.
Keep your eyeballs peeled for that one.
But it was a great, as I said, it was water cooler talk. You know, I think people who don't even follow the sport were watching that and were a lot of brought up a lot of hard memories. And there weren't any winners in this case, and it was tough to watch, especially knowing what we know now, and a lot to unpack from that, and we'll talk about that later this week, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that I was so excited for it But at the same time, there was almost an aspect where being excited for the beginning of this program almost felt morbid. It felt almost inappropriate in a way. But it almost felt inappropriate. I tweeted this after about 15 minutes in. You know, here we are in this, what essentially amounted to a legal courtroom documentary that featured the accusation of a heinous crime. And I couldn't overcome how excited I was for the 2006 Duke Blue Devils. So those of you that have listened to this podcast know, you know, in pretty real detail how my fanship with the sport, you know, grew and crescendoed right around that time. So in 2005, I had spent, you know, two seasons with Inside Lacrosse in kind of a intern-type volunteer capacity. And the 2005 Blue Devils were so captivating in the sense that they were so exciting to watch. They were so new on the scene. They had not been that good in 2004, and you knew how sustainable it was. You knew how good this program was going to be in 2006. It felt like a watershed moment. And the fact that, you know, this case, this situation, deprived lacrosse fans of seeing that this season is certainly nowhere near the top of the list of injustices. But now 10 years on, I just am struck by how significant that impression remains with me. And I hope that what it says about me is that I really am a genuine lacrosse fan. I didn't find my infatuation with this news story in real time to be a function of I like courtroom drama. I wasn't going out and subscribing to court TV. You know, this was, I'm a lacrosse guy, and this is the biggest story that our sport has experienced. So it was an interesting exercise to revisit it 10 years later and really enjoyed the social media reaction to it. Shout out to ESPN and 30 for 30. They did a great job of providing additional content, essentially exactly what we talked about in terms of having a landing page for our podcast. That's what following 30 for 30 on Twitter is like when they're debuting a show, and it was excellent. It was almost as at every turn there was a new piece of, you know, supplementary data that was joining the conversation. I thought that Jay Billis's full letter to the Duke magazine about calling for President Broadhead's resignation was the most interesting use of that.
Yeah, there's a ton of things to talk about in this, and it really does stir some emotions and some memories, and we will talk about this in more detail later. But let's get to some more exciting, happy things.
To the games.
Terry has got his chips, he's got his guac, and it's time to crack his soda. Oh, can you hear that?
I've been wanting to drink this for cool, 20 refreshing. Minutes. Cool, refreshing. I was like, can we just get to this? Come on.
Yeah. So to the games. We'll start in South Bend with the big game of the week. Three games in a row have been decided by overtime, four of the last five. This Sunday instant classic really couldn't have ended up any other way. Down by five goals to start the fourth quarter, six-goal run by Notre Dame, which included four goals in 43 seconds, gave them an 8-7 lead, only for number two Denver to tie things up and eventually pull out the win in overtime when Zach Miller cut to a spot in front of the goal, a dozen or so yards out, and buried a feed from Connor Canizzaro.
So a couple of things about this. The first is Denver, in building that 7-2 lead in the first half, because it was a scoreless third quarter, you almost felt like this game could have just excised the third quarter completely and it wouldn't have really changed how anything happened. And I don't say that just because of the fact that there were no goals scored. I mean, it almost felt like it was a run of play that just reflected what was coming and what had passed. Demonstrated their dominance, and I think that Notre Dame got up 1-0 on what appeared like a little bit of a fluky P.J. Finley goal after Notre Dame won the faceoff, and then he ended up kind of being uncovered around the crease and was able to finish a feed. From that point on, the way in which Denver was able to lock Notre Dame down defensively was remarkable. You know, this is a team that graduated a starting defenseman and a starting long stick midi from their national championship squad and lost a presumptive starter for the season due to injury prior to 2016. So, you know, three poles breaking in, and I thought they did a really nice job. Dylan Johnson was certainly on the ball a lot and held his own. I think that it's difficult for me to identify whether this was a lack of explosive dodging from Notre Dame and quick ball movement to supplement the fact that they couldn't, or overcome the fact that they couldn't win their matchups, or if it was just really aggressive, effective on-ball defense from a team of six Denver individuals that coincided with really well-organized cohesion as a unit. And then, obviously, freshman goalie Alex Reddy. You know, first would like to just kind of throw it back to January when he Yeah, I remember writing it at the time. It's awkward to say about a defensive performance that gave up double-digit goals and a half, but it felt like Alex Reddy was capable to play on this stage, and I thought that we saw that yesterday. He finished with 14 saves against Notre Dame, I believe six of which came against Sergio Perkovic. And it's, you know, certainly worth the conversation of if one or two of those fall and Denver has to extend their defense a little further out to number 16's hands, does the game unfold considerably differently? Maybe so. But as it was, Notre Dame only put up two goals in the first three quarters. And then, like you said, I mean, you know, they showed to me the biggest attribute that Notre Dame has as a program is how well coached they are. And that's not to be disparaging of any other program, certainly not Denver, whose coaching staff is as good as any in the country. But the gap between what it feels like Notre Dame should be capable of from the aggregate talent on their roster, between that gap, that, and what they actually achieve, is so wide, and you attribute it, I attribute it to their coaching. And I thought that the way that they approached a face-off deficiency and the way that they were able to incorporate that to win the ball back, I don't know for sure that they lost all four face-offs in that four-goal stretch, but I believe that they lost at least two, if not three of them. And that did not deter them, number one, from being able to make this comeback, and number two, from being able to make this comeback in very quick order. So just an incredible, incredible performance on both ends. A game that, you know, despite a slow pace for the first 45 minutes, certainly lived up to what a number one versus number two should be.
I think the comeback is responsible, can be held responsible to the Jerry Byrne rally cap. I'm watching the game on TV, Terry, and they call, first of all, I don't understand why Bill Tierney didn't call a timeout a little bit earlier. He waited until it was 8-7. And they come in, and Notre Dame, I noticed Jerry Byrne's cap, his, like, knit cap that is inside out and backwards. It didn't say Notre Dame on it, or I couldn't see the Under Armour logo either. But he had it inside. I was like, is that his version of a lacrosse rally cap, a South Bend rally cap in middle of March outside? And it definitely corresponded with their run.
Yeah, well, if that's the case, then do you come out of the gate with your hat inside out and backwards on, you know, the beginning of your next game?
No.
You think he turned it around for overtime?
You only pull that out when you
when
need
it. When you need a rally.
When you need it. He probably turned it around once they were up 8-7.
So as far as number one versus number two matchups go, like I said, this was incredibly fitting. You mentioned how great a spot Arlotta Stadium has been. But I wanted to call attention to a game that happened 23 years ago, November of 1993, when the – I actually don't remember who was number one and who was number two, but the Florida State Seminoles came to South Bend. Charlie Ward, I remember scrambling to his left, throwing a pass into the end zone that either would have tied or won the game. You'll have to forgive me for not remembering the details. I was nine. I remember the pass was knocked down, and Notre Dame emerged victorious. Took a number one ranking into Boston College the subsequent weekend, the last weekend of the regular season, and fell short.
Oh, I remember that.
But between the color of the opponent's uniforms, garnet and gold, I don't know if I'm assuming that the Pioneers do not refer to their maroon color as garnet, but and the overcast nature, 5 o'clock in South Bend, Indiana. I mean, it was just so similar. It was awesome. That was one of my favorite football games of all time.
There were some great call, by the way, great pull on that one. I'm a big Notre Dame football fan. We covered that a little bit, and I certainly remember that game and the game against BC the week later. Which didn't go so well. There was just some great plays when the Baptiste, the way he corralled the faceoff in overtime, just an amazing athletic play, kind of tiptoeing down the sideline before they ran a play. They didn't call timeout just then, and Zach Miller was not in the game. He did not come back in. He wasn't substituted in after faceoff. They called timeout after taking a shot and getting the ball back. They called timeout. And then he comes in.
Which is crazy because he's been taking a lot of the wings of faceoffs. And people have been critical of Denver for that because they've said, you got this guy is so integral to your offense. You've got to keep him fresh for settled six-on-six situations. But, I mean, we saw it. He's so good off the ground. He's so good in those tight scrums and he's dangerous with the ball and a stick. I mean, Zach Miller is just so good. And to your point about the game winner, again, one of those situations I'm not totally certain whether or not I'm correct. However, I believe his North Carolina game winner last week was lefty from about 10 or 12 yards. And I believe that this one, no, I'm sorry, I think it was righty from the left wing, and this one was lefty from the center of the field. I apologize if I'm incorrect, but that's the way I'm remembering it. And if that's the case, then it certainly speaks to the fact that, you know, he's a multifaceted, multi-skilled, multi-talented, very, you know, a player with very few limitations.
So I got to ask you, when Miller scored the game winner, it was Landis who was recovering out on him. What was he doing? Why is maybe the best player on the field? What did he get beat? Did he make a mistake? Was he helping someone else?
Well,
what's your take on that?
So Notre Dame famously does not. They're not matchup conscious, and they're not afraid to switch. So opponents can find their best player being guarded by a short stick relatively quickly, relatively frequently. And the inverse of that, the way in which you can be comfortable with those decisions, is by being very aggressive in your sliding and also very diligent in when you make a decision to slide. So Notre Dame as a team will slide quicker than most to most people, to most teams, but they don't. So the reason I say this is because I didn't notice that, but the likelihood is that it was a long possession, and there had been multiple switches on that point, so that Landis, who probably should have been guarding Connor Cannizzaro if Notre Dame had had their druthers, at which point he would have been far away from the ball when Zach Miller caught it, was covering somebody else and was a backside slide and was just scrambling, trying to prevent a dangerous opportunity.
A couple of plays in that game that just were so fun to watch. It's Notre Dame's down 7-6, and Mikey Wynn strips Baptiste, comes down the right alley, blasts a left shot just off hip to the goalie. Amazing goal to tie it up. And then Kavanaugh's shot, he had a shot with about 10 seconds left, just missed by a hair wide left. Just so fun to watch this game.
We, in his top 20 this week, Quint mentioned that Mikey Wynn is much more than a catch-and-shoot finisher, and he may have stolen that from us. We talked about that last week, and that was my impression of Mikey Wynn coming away from that Maryland game. There's no question that Notre Dame is going to have to figure out, they're going to have to manufacture ways to be dangerous with the ball that they relied on Connor Doyle for last year, and Ryder Garnsey hasn't stepped up in the way that it would have been unfair to expect him to step up to this degree as a freshman, and in the way that he likely will between now and the end of the season. That being said, for a good stretch of this game, it just looked like there wasn't a Notre Dame offensive player that was able to run past his matchup. And you know, whether that's Brendan Collins, which it very well might end up being, because he's probably the most likely best combination of capable and having the most likely opportunity to do so, because he's going to be guarded with a short stick so frequently. That's what's next for Notre Dame. You know, probably the biggest question mark for them heading into the season was at the faceoff X. I think they've answered that question, because whether PJ Finley is winning these draws cleanly and traditionally, or Notre Dame is going to scheme their way out of it, it's clear that that's not a long-term problem. In a grinded-out possession-style 6-on-6 game, which you saw a little bit of problems with against Maryland as well, before, you know, they only scored 3 goals through 40-some minutes against Maryland, too. You know, where's that offense going to come from? And I think that that's what the remainder of their season is going to tell. There are some matchups that's not going to be apparent or noticeable. You know, they're not going to have that issue against Virginia and Carolina, and probably not against Duke and Syracuse either. But if they see Denver and Maryland again, if they end up crossing paths with Yale, there are going to be a few teams that are going to be able to put some clamps on Notre Dame, and it's going to be an interesting question to see how they answer that question.
Well, one way they can answer that is Denver dominated the ground balls, 43-24. They were pretty even on faceoffs. I think it was like 12-9.
Yeah.
But in the middle of the field, it's not a lack of hustle. Denver is very good at it, but
they look
winning
sloppy
by
on
almost 20 ground balls.
Notre Dame looked sloppy on first-time ground balls.
And there were some unforced errors. There was at times some sloppy play in this game, just some just passing and catching errors on both teams that, you know, again, it's early in the season. It's not even the middle of March yet. So there's a lot of time to get better. And that's what March is really for, is getting better. Terry, you know, you did predict a 9-8 score in this game, but you had the Fighting Irish winning this one. But I got to give you some credit for nailing the over-under with overtime, no less, and calling out the score, and it would be a close game. But, yeah, it was a dandy for folks to watch. Moving on to some other games. Penn State 13, Harvard 12. Harvard plays another overtime game, their fourth of the season. This time they end up on the losing side of it. Lots of momentum swings, and it was so much fun to watch a game, like wake up and watch a game on TV at 10 a.m.
I mean, I've said many times that that's one of the biggest assets that the Premier League has in the United States.
Sure.
It doesn't have to compete with anything.
Yeah.
There's no live sporting event that's occurring at 7:45 in the morning on the East Coast.
And there are a lot of bros waking up around that time or like from the night before looking for something to do. And it's perfect to have that on TV. And it's what I was watching it. Again, I'm getting up at like 7 o'clock on Saturday mornings with my kids. But I have to wait for the games to come on. But it's not great for the people who are there. Probably not exactly great for the players, but for fans at home, it is outstanding to be able to turn the game on and see high-quality lacrosse at 10 a.m.
I don't know how bad it is for the players, particularly because it's, I think, become more common. And I know that this isn't as common in the spring as it is in the fall, but it's more common for teams to practice in the morning. And so,
That's a good point.
If you're used to that, then you know it's a little bit easier to adjust. And then secondly, you know, you hear coaches talk about it more frequently than players, but there's a combination. There's positives and negatives to playing early versus late. When you play early, yeah, you don't have as much time to go through your normal routines to get your body ready, but you also don't have as much time to handle the nervous energy of getting ready to play. So I could see it being a pretty solid 6-1, half dozen of the other.
The Penn State attack unit notched 8 of the Nittany Lion goals.
They combined for 16 points.
Assists. Yeah, great day for their attack. Devin Dwyer, 4 goals and 2 assists for Harvard. Morgan Cheek held to only 3 points with 2 goals and 1 assist. What are some of your other points
of
this one?
Well, I think that, you know, for me it starts with Penn State's attack, and it's because obviously the attention has been paid to Grant Ament and his impressive start. I ranked him 10th among freshmen so far this season. That was he would have been higher had it not been for a function of the fact that 7 of his, I believe, 20 points in his first 5 games came against Robert Morris in their opener when he had 2 goals and 5 assists. But I believe he finished with 3-2 in this one. And so he combined with TJ Sanders and Nick Aponte. I'll put it this way. When you think of a Jeff Tambroni offense, you think of a big, traditional alley-dodging midfielder, Joe Belukis, Max Seabold, John Glenn. And I think since arriving at Penn State, I have been waiting for that big, powerful alley-dodging midfielder to arrive and to be able to trigger what would be Penn State's emulation of what Tambo did when he was at Cornell. It doesn't feel like it's going to come. There are some good middies in that program. There have been some good middies that have come through Happy Valley during the Tambroni era. But it feels like if that guy were going to arrive, he would have arrived already. And not only that, it's kind of a dead way to play lacrosse. And we haven't seen a ton of Paul Rabels and Max Seabolds in college lacrosse over the last couple of years anyway.
Yeah.
So my point is, what I'm driving at is, that means that you need to a little bit reinvent yourself offensively. And I think that that's what we've seen in terms of the efficiency of this attack group. When they're playing at their best and against a top 10 opponent who now has lost 2 games in a row and was playing without, you know, one of its top line defenders in Steven Jahelka, you can get, you know, 16 points in a 13 goal game. And I think the coach staff deserves credit for being nimble enough to adjust to that. And I think that the players deserve credit for being good enough to execute a game plan that facilitated that.
And Will Schreiner in goal for Penn State, 10 saves. When we talk about Penn State goalie, your broadcast or webcast observation of the week sort of ties and leads right into that.
Yeah, so, you know, Penn State has been on the kind of in and out of the top 20 a couple times over the course of this season so far, and I've gotten asked a couple times. You know, and to me, that exceeds expectations. We had him ranked number 28 in Faceoff Yearbook. There were a lot of question marks about this squad coming away from last season. Goalie was supposed to be a strength for this team in 2016 and 2017 as Connor Darcy emerged as a bona fide starter in 2015 as a redshirt sophomore. And obviously his tragic death last June impacted this program in a meaningful way. It's difficult to talk about its on-field implications. Whenever a player dies, there are so many things that matter more than how his team is going to fill the hole that from a personnel, from a production standpoint. But the fact of the matter is that part of Penn State's instability, unevenness maybe, has been that they've gotten 45% in the goal. You can't put that at the feet of any one player, particularly a player who at this time last year was not penciled in to be a starter. So when Will Schreiner is able to make 10 saves and allow 12 goals but make a huge save in overtime, the key transition that led to the game-winning goal from Nick Aponte, you deserve a lot of credit as a player, as a team, as a group, for being able to coalesce and do that, you know, much less against an opponent like Harvard on national TV. But the function of it being on national TV, we already talked about a couple of the interesting quirks of this, and you know, my first observation was obviously about the fact that the game was on at 10 a.m. At halftime, ESPN aired a segment remembering Connor Darcy, and really, I thought, poignantly showed how his teammates are coping with his loss. And it's certainly it's the type of segment that we've seen before, but every single time you have an opportunity to see an individual, you know, a 21-year-old man who plays college sports process the loss of a friend and a teammate, I feel like it's an enriching viewing experience. And so kudos to ESPN for producing that segment and airing it. It was something that I did not know was coming. And, you know, given how much promotion around lacrosse there was heading into this weekend, I was very taken by surprise that this found its way into Mark Dixon and Matt Ward's broadcast.
Speaking of that, I turn my TV on and I hear my man, my old friend, Mark Dixon, in my living room, like 10:15 in the morning on Saturday. Again, I didn't know the game was on. I just was flipping around and caught it. And I was like, is that Dixon? I said to my wife, is that Dixon? She's like, yes. I was like, okay. He's in our living room, 10 o'clock in the morning. Always a pleasure. But ESPN had a great week. You know who didn't have a great week, Terry? Harvard. Last week, they were number 7 in the Cascade Maverick IL Men's Media Top 20. Lost two games. You know, you called the upset, or you predicted two upsets last week. Albany was able to pull out a win, but Bryant knocks off Harvard 12-9, and then they fall on the road in State College 13-12.
I think the Jahelka absence is important. So
yeah, I would say so.
I don't want to, you know, you never, I feel like coaches, you know, that's next man up. That's no excuses type of situation. I think that, you know, losing in overtime at 10 a.m. on a Saturday on national TV, well, against a top 20 opponent or a borderline top 20 opponent, the Bryant loss felt like a team that, you know, we know pretty well coming out of Cambridge, and it's show me how you handle adversity. And I think that now we're going to have an opportunity to see that in an even more meaningful way.
And they'll have a big game coming up. They'll play Brown, who's number 5, who just keeps on rolling, and that's going to be a fun one to watch.
And honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if Harvard won this Brown game. But we'll get to those top 5 matchups toward the end of the podcast.
Let's talk about a couple more games, Terry. Cornell 14, Virginia 10. Good game for, you know, the Big Red. They get a much needed win, but more of this game is more about just how much Virginia is struggling.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you know, it's hard to say that when Cavaliers hit the road, go up to the Crescent, as it's called, in beautiful Ithaca, New York.
Schaltkopf Field.
Yes, there are a lot more consonants in that name than you might otherwise expect. This game was 9-9 heading into the fourth quarter, and Cornell outscored Virginia 5-1. They won 5 of 7 faceoffs and outshot Virginia 10-3. And to me, it underscored what has been a struggling Virginia defense that is ranked number 44 in Division One. They couldn't contain a Cornell offense that's ranked number 38 in Division One, and I just can't get past how much of that may fall at the feet of a goalie who's a second team All-American in 2015, but is stopping only 44% this year. That's 55th in Division One. What was expected to be a strength in net for Virginia has not proven to be so. And I think that, you know, it's difficult to put a finger on why. It's difficult to put a finger on exactly how significant that is, but it's certainly not easy to overlook.
And for our more casual listeners, 55th is out of 70.
And for our more casual listeners, a good goalie will stop between 52 and 56%. A great goalie will stop between 57 and 60%. And a exceptional goalie will stop more than 60%. Once you get into the 49 and below range, then you start, as a program, looking for alternatives. And
So that's the next question. Who do they go to? Do they go to Dan Marino?
Well, so he was suspended for 3 games to start the season, and it doesn't seem like that's a decision that the program is going to be very interested in making.
So, I mean, Will Raley, sophomore from Chevy Chase, or Ryan Montgomery from Garner Valley, PA, are your other options on the roster?
I think Will Raley would be the one that I would look at most readily.
Moving on, another game, Homewood Field, game I watched with my buddy Brad. Another good game for Hopkins. Their offense seems like it's back. They're less unforced errors and playing what Blue Jays fans would call Hopkins lacrosse, looking pretty good. They get a great game out of Shaq Stanwyck with 7 points, 4 goals, and 3 assists. Ryan Brown finds his mojo again after being held scoreless.
A new streak has started.
And he celebrated his first goal with a lot of enthusiasm, as he should. His passion was great, and it was a well-deserved goal. But he has 4 goals and 1 assist, and the Blue Jays get a good win over a Towson team that looked like they had been on a roll and sort of figured out their defense.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you know, that was certainly the storyline heading in. I think a lot of people made comments about we made a comment about Ryan Brown against Tyler White, who I was glad to hear the broadcast team call potentially the best goalie in the country. I think that with Hopkins putting up 14 goals, there's a function of this that's very positive. There's a function of this that, for me, I wonder if they've fully figured it out. So they got 5 goals and 5 assists from Drew Sapinski, the combination of Drew Sapinski, Holden Cotone, Wilkin Smuk, and Cody Ratzowitz. Each guy had at least 1 goal and 1 assist. Sapinski had 2 and 2. So that's great. Essentially, you're at a point where you could almost win a game in which Towson only scores 8 goals with that contribution. It's clear to me, however, that in order for Hopkins to beat teams handily, they need great games out of Stanwyck and Brown. And the question that I have is, number one, can you expect – I mean, there's no question. Shaq and Ryan Brown are great players, but even great players don't necessarily put up 7 and 5 points in every game. And then secondly, when they play great teams with 2 top-tier defensemen and a scheme that is well-developed on the basis of scouting, can Hopkins rely on that? I agree with you. They sewed up a lot of their issues, a lot of their mistakes, and – they controlled this game. I mean, this was not a contest that was in doubt. That being said, is the offense... I mean, I guess there's no alternatives, right? When you don't have Joel Tinney and Connor Reed, like, you need your best players to play great games in order to beat good teams, and Towson certainly was that. So, you know, maybe the standard that I'm trying to put at Hopkins is too high, but I'm thinking about this from a Final Four perspective, or really, I'm thinking about it from a quarterfinal perspective. They're going to have to beat a good team in the quarterfinals. Can they do it if Ryan Brown and Shaq Stanwyck only combine for 6 points as opposed to 12?
Well, they're getting more production out of their midfield. Drew Sapinski missed the Carolina game. He had 2 and 2 this week, and he's a difference maker, and he's going to continue to develop. It seemed also like they're on their clearing. They you know, getting the ball to guys like Holden Cotone and just letting him run, which I don't think they were doing before.
No, that was not something that was happening.
And they're coming along, and they got a very interesting game this week that will tell us a lot about both teams, I think. There were some other interesting things in this game that I want to get your thoughts on. Nick Fields was covering Ryan Drenner, who's Towson's leading scorer, held him without a point. That was a significant accomplishment. And then the other thing is I love watching this kid for the guy who's the number 16, Jack Adams, who was basically covering Ryan Brown, a short stick defensive midfielder for Towson, who did a fantastic job covering him. But I want like your opinion on – I saw a little bit of that yesterday in the Notre Dame-Denver game, where at times they had a short stick on like a top offensive player.
Well, right, yeah. So, I mean, that was something that Notre Dame tried to do with keeping Sergio Perkovic on attack and then having Ryder Garnsey sub out of the box, and he would at times draw a short stick as a result. All right, well, first on Nick Fields. So Nick Fields, the thing that always impressed me about him is that he plays so tall, and he plays with a little bit of like a shoulders forward, not a hunch the way that Joe Fletcher does. That actually almost feels like it keeps him like it almost Joe Fletcher's hunch, which is similar to Brody Merrill's. I envision it as essentially like a reverse puppeteer, where they kind of have their body is being pulled down in a positive way, because what it means is that they're like glued to the ground, so they're more in control. They can stop faster, they can change direction faster, and for a defensive player, that's enormous. With Nick Fields, it almost feels like the opposite is happening. He's using his verticality in a really rangy kind of way. So it's like it's almost like a pass rusher. Like Cameron Wake is somebody that people talk about as having incredible lateral bend. He can get so low with his hips. Von Miller is another one that they can create leverage against bigger offensive tackles and get underneath them. And so with Fields, it almost strikes me that he's able to do it in reverse. He's able to use his height to kind of get on top of somebody and almost beat him down, and particularly when he's guarding tall players and he doesn't have to be involved in an incredibly complex overall defensive scheme, and his job is primarily just take that guy out of the game. That's when I've seen him play his best games, and that was kind of the way that I interpreted his performance against Ryan Drenner. And as for, you know, how... If I understand you correctly, you didn't really ask a question, but if you were to ask a question, it would probably be how does a short stick do a good job guarding an elite attackman?
That is the question, but not many people have a guy of Jack Adams' size and capability, and I just thought it was an interesting way to try to shut down a prolific scorer like Ryan Brown.
Well, what's also interesting about it is that typically if you have a good short stick that you really like, you know, think of the Loyola 2012 through 14 teams. You want to play as straight up and traditional as possible, because you know that your opponent is most likely to try to pick on those guys. But if you think you're going to win those matchups, then you're basically saying, "All right, we're taking you out of your conventional offense." So you rarely see good short sticks be put into a role where they're expected to cover attackmen, because you'd rather just play straight up and beat your opponent. At least that's my...
Is there something belief to be said, like, look, that guy's going to get his... What we'll do is we'll put a pole on someone else and shut that guy completely off.
That happens.
Shut him out.
One of the other things that happens is we're going to put a shorty on him because we know we're going to slide to that guy all the time. So we might as well slide with a pole and not have to worry about sliding with a shorty. So I don't know. I mean, it's very nuanced. And I have to say, you know, I didn't notice too dramatically. And again, there's also... There are so many different types of players that get short-sticked. Ryan Brown is an elite-level player. Like, typically, you know, if you're double-pulling a midfield, it's just that the opponent has an attackman that you're not concerned about getting beaten by. But, like, Dylan Donahue used to get a pull. If he'd do that, he'd throw five assists. He'd, you know, just be able to throw over a pull. Ryan Brown, you know, in that situation, he's going to try to get his goals. He's going to get his hands free from 10 yards and beat goalies.
So one of the issues for Hopkins has been the clearing game.
You mentioned that earlier. Yeah.
Yeah. You have a note here that they, you know, they did much better, 12 of 13 attempts versus Towson, but...
Hold on. Well, let's just make sure that the table is fairly set. Johns Hopkins is 46th in the country, clearing the ball at 83%. It was instrumental in their losses to Loyola and Carolina.
Correct.
However, like you said, they were 12 of 13 clearing the ball against Towson, which is important because they managed to score four goals despite turning the ball over 11 times offensively. However,
the one time they did not, it was the Keystone Cops trying to clear the ball. And our friend Patrick...
P-Mix. P-Mix
at the La Crosse Lax Film Room put together a hilarious vine that is them trying to clear the ball. And it's real time. It's not no editing. And then he just threw yakety sacks behind it. And I could watch that all day long, even though it's my team. It's embarrassing.
I mean, yeah, it was just one of those... It was just one of those plays where everything goes wrong. You thought, I mean, it was
but
so funny.
Everything goes right in that video.
It absolutely does. There's one time
the goalie falls down.
Yeah, when Brock Turnbull loses his footing. And it's like, it's that lull in Yakety Sack where it just like picks back up at the perfect moment. You know, and then there's one moment when the ball is just rolling away from Nick Fields and it looks like it's like speeding up as it's getting far, as like he's getting closer. The ball is like gaining speed. It was so.
So we will make our homepage because of the John Tavares video, but this is why you're going to want to really go there to see this video that we'll post. And that's our Twitter follow of the week is Patrick McEwen.
And he might be a returning. I think we're five podcasts in, and this might be his second.
Well, he does good work, and he needs to. If you're a lacrosse fan, you need to be following this. He was at the game yesterday.
He was, yeah,
and had some great coverage of that. And his what's his handle at
Lax Film Room
at Lax Film Room on Twitter. One more game to recap. Loyola and Duke got together for their annual sort of mid-March clash. And big win for Duke, who had an upset earlier in the week at Richmond. Great win for Richmond and their young program to get a win over Duke, a team of Duke's caliber. But a great bounce-back win for the Blue Devils.
And I think that... You know, for me, I know that this is oversimplifying it, but after I believe he was held to 1 point combined against Harvard and Richmond, Miles Jones put up 5 goals and 3 assists against Loyola on Saturday. And honestly, he accounted for a couple more goals that didn't end up in the box score as well. You know, there was one play. He dodged right-handed down the alley, drew a slide, threw this real awkward back pass, but it was a good pass, and then... It was 2 more Duke passes before a goal. Those are the types of plays that when Miles Jones is playing well, defenses have to account for. And the goal is a function of how much space Jones created for his teammates on the opposite side of the field. When he had been limited into Duke losses and he had fallen to fourth on Duke's scoring leaders charts, you started to hear more conversation about whether or not Miles Jones is a bona fide Tewarton finalist. After having been so in 2015 and entering 2016, in my opinion, as the presumptive favorite. I will say that I didn't waver in my belief that he was still the presumptive favorite, despite having 19 points, excuse me, through, I believe, 6 games. There's a little bit of indication, although certainly there's a lot more to be played. There's a lot of a long way to go. But I was heartened by John Donowski's comments post-game, in which he basically said, these guys are kids. They look like men. They are men in many ways. But sometimes you don't realize what the pressure of having to be Mr. Lacrosse all the time might do to a player like Miles Jones. And certainly he's shown himself incredibly capable of handling that on multiple fronts. I just don't have any time for the idea that Miles Jones is overrated. Like, talk to an opposing coach about how overrated a guy that's had to scout Miles Jones. Talk to him about how overrated Miles Jones is. I have, and I have not heard anybody call him overrated. Chris Brzezinski, who beat him on Monday.
Yeah. He was petrified.
Not calling Miles Jones overrated.
Petrified of scouting, you know, in Richmond's preparation, scouting Duke and watching Miles Jones. I think he tweeted or had like some Instagram post saying like, how do I stop this man beast? What do I do? Obviously they came up with a decent game plan, but he's got 31 points in their 8 games. Duke has 8 games under their belt.
You know how hard it is for a midfielder to average 4 points a game? There are not that many guys that do it. 31 is a good raw number for sure. That 4 points per game number is going to continue to separate itself. Yeah, it's not the six or five that he was approaching at his heights last season, but, you know, seasons unfold in different ways for different players. I think we should all just...
I think this game shows what he's capable of. Against a good opponent, to put up 5 goals and 3 assists, this really shows you what he can do and what you can expect from him.
So, I mean, there was a lot more to this game. I think that, you know, Loyola's offensive struggles are real. I think in this one, it's going to hide beneath a layer of not getting the ball. Kyle Rowe was very, very good. Loyola threw 2 different faceoff guys at him and didn't have any answers. You know, Jeff Chase did not play. And I think that he is instrumental to Loyola having a little bit of scoring depth. I've had the conversation a couple times. I'd like to see what the Greyhounds look like if he's that right-handed attackman, and see if Zach Sirico can be the trigger man of the second midfield. I think that that would be a really interesting move that Loyola could explore, that would help supplement what Loyola has become with Pat Spencer. You know, the way they're composed right now, they feel like they should be a two-man-behind type of offense, because Sirico and Spencer are... Sirico is your, you know, kind of more traditional distributor. Spencer is your more traditional dodging, feeding quarterback attackman. I think he is going to be at his best if he's alone behind in a 2-3-1. And if that's the case, then you got Harewires playing that lefty shooter spot, and it would be interesting to see Chase in that righty shooter spot. Ultimately, you know, Loyola is a team that I think now should reset its sights on winning the Patriot League, you know, taking the number one seed into the Patriot League tournament and hosting and winning the tournament again, and then reassess. They certainly don't look like a Final Four or National Championship contender the way that they did 2 weeks into the season.
You had a comment about how this game fits into Loyola's schedule.
It's very interesting because everybody focuses on the idea that Duke loses games early in the season, in February or early March, and then they get better as the season goes along. It's rare that you really focus on who is on the receiving end of that improvement. And when and why. Sure. So we have seen Duke improve dramatically over the course of their spring break. It's an interesting phenomenon given the fact that the Fantastic Lies party was a spring break party. But over the course of the, you know, particularly since the 2010 team on, we started to hear about this shooters camp or shooters academy, and basically it's just an early morning shooting session that Ron Caputo and now Matt Donowski do with the offensive players every day over spring break. And I think that combined with you know, a lot of other team exercise type stuff ends up really rapidly ascending the quality of play that this team puts on the field. And I don't know if it's every single year, but most years Loyola is that second game of spring break. And so they're getting a energized, refreshed, and focused, as well as dialed in Duke team. It's a series that is now sits 18-11 in favor of the Blue Devils. But I remember distinctly in 2012 talking to Coach Cottle, who called the Loyola game for the webcast, and his comment that Loyola has division national championship level athletes after they beat Duke on a day that we hosted a face-off classic at M&T Bank Stadium. And that was significant to me because it was a year that Duke had had its traditional couple of slip-ups. But his comment wasn't about how Duke played. It was about how athletic Loyola looked. And, you know, that stands out in my memory as being, you know, significant. But typically, it's been the other direction, which is that Duke is really, really good when they play Loyola.
Into the week ahead, Terry. Let's move on. It is spring break for a lot of teams.
Is it still?
Well, yeah. I mean, like Hopkins, this is their sandwich of their spring break. Or it started last week, and it's coming up through this week. So some schools are coming back. Some are in spring break right now. There are some 13 midweek games, which isn't a lot, but the really good quality, and highlighted by tomorrow night's game on the island, Hofstra and Stony Brook. And what a week it's been for Stony Brook. Their men's basketball team makes the first NCAA tournament ever. And the Seawolves women's team, women's lacrosse team, is ranked number 10, Joseph Williams' team. And their men's team is number 15 this week in the media, our media poll. And they got a big game on the island. If you are a lacrosse fan and you live on Long Island, you got to get out to Stony Brook tomorrow night at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it was funny, too. They hosted the America East basketball tournament. That's got to be tough, man, to get there for, you know, people talk about getting to Hofstra, getting to Stony Brook, just the traffic getting through New York City, how difficult it is to play there.
Take that's a ferry.
That's why Hopkins doesn't play Hofstra anymore, just because it was so difficult to get up there.
I was on the receiving end of a lot of the traffic sometimes.
Yeah,
going to that game.
Yeah, it's brutal. But you're right. This is a good one, and it's interesting because, you know, I think I went from being slow on Hofstra. I did not put them in the top 20 the week after they beat Carolina, to now I have them higher, more highly ranked than the media aggregate does. I still have some question marks about them. That being said, I still have some question marks about Stony Brook. Their goalie situation, it has been excellent, but it mystifies me. I don't understand, you know, who. I don't understand who's the starter and what the status of the goalie situation is. You know, I don't understand how you graduate a 99-point scorer or a 100-point scorer in Mike Rooney, and your offense apparently gets better. It's going to be a good one. It's going to be. It feels like. I don't want to overstate the idea of contrasting styles, but it feels like a game of contrasting styles. So it should be a treat, no question about it.
Two other games Tuesday, March 15th, maybe the day that you're listening to this. Number 7, Villanova, with a meteoric rise up the polls, and they're playing great, scoring a lot of goals. Go to Bucknell for a 3 o'clock game. And number 9, Towson, is at Ohio State at 7 o'clock for another game. And then Wednesday, another big game, Maryland and Albany.
That Maryland-Albany game is the one that I have circled because I don't think Maryland's in a position where they need to start racking up top 20 wins, but you do wonder. They're going to get there before long. I mean, obviously, with Ohio State struggling, that is one that you probably would have expected, but, you know, that could be supplemented by Penn State as long as they win a game or two. And then certainly Rutgers being better. Maybe they don't necessarily need those out-of-conference top 20 wins in a way that you might have thought that they were going to. But Albany is not going to get much worse than 10 to 12, even if they lose this game to Maryland. And if they win, Albany isn't going to play opponents that are that good to the degree that you're going to have to worry about them that much. So, and by that, I mean from a NCAA at large berth perspective. So this is a big game that has significant implications, you know, heading into April for a game that's occurring on March 15th.
And then this weekend,
16th, excuse me.
And this weekend, it's a huge weekend. Saturday,
huge.
Saturday has two games on the air. Syracuse at Johns Hopkins, Homewood Field, 4 o'clock on ESPNU, and Ohio State at Denver, 3 o'clock on Fox Sports.
Ohio State beat Denver last year. This was the upset that. Not only, you know, kind of catapulted Ohio State into the NCAA tournament, but also really caught people by surprise. And then I think it was a week later that Ohio State turned around and got shut out by Notre Dame. Yeah. So those two games are a part of a cluster of each top five team, in my opinion. This is the storyline for this coming weekend. Each top five team, and do you want to continue on with the remaining schedule? We already talked about, you know, so.
Yeah, just looking at the Cascade Maverick game calendar on InsideLacrosse.com, there's two other broadcast games on ESPN3 that both should be pretty interesting. Brown is at Harvard at 1 o'clock, and Richmond's at North Carolina at 7 on Saturday.
We'll set that Richmond-North Carolina game away aside for the moment. Notre Dame is taking on Virginia. And that rounds out. We talked about Syracuse obviously taking on Hopkins. I'm sorry. We haven't mentioned that Yale is playing Cornell. So we've got our top five teams, Denver, Notre Dame, Syracuse, Brown, and Yale, all playing opponents that I think they could lose to. I don't think all five of them are going to lose. I wouldn't be stunned if all five of them won. But the storyline for this weekend, in my opinion, is that all five top five teams have bona fide games that they could actually lose.
And what...
Are you going to make me pick one?
Yeah. I want you to pick who your upset special
is. I feel like I just walked into that.
You did.
Why don't you pick one? Oh, you walked into that.
I think Hopkins is going to beat Syracuse.
Okay.
I mean, Syracuse has played great this season. But outside of their win, which was a very strong win against Albany, I don't think that they've played some of the caliber of opponents that Hopkins has. And Hopkins is starting to come together a little bit. And it'll be at Homewood Field, which is a little bit of an advantage. Maybe not so much for Hopkins, but not having to play in the Dome, I think, is an advantage for the Blue Jays, more so than whatever home field advantage Homewood gives you. So I'll take Hopkins if I got to pick one.
That's logical, and I would actually say that when the lines come out, that's probably going to be the one that at least has the best story for the underdog. It would be the game that, if that were the result, would change my opinion of the team that lost the most. I think that if Syracuse loses to Hopkins, I'm going to feel less good about Syracuse than I would if any of the other four teams lost their games, which totally acknowledges that Hopkins is not, by a wide stretch, the worst team of those five opponents. It just means that the gap between what I perceive them to be and what this loss would mean. I mean, if Denver loses to Ohio State, they lost to Ohio State and won the national championship last year. That's a function of the way that the schedule works and the game works and stuff like that. I suppose you could very easily make that argument about Syracuse, but if I have to pick one...
I'm a runner-up candidate.
I'm going to pick Yale having to go to Cornell, play at Shulkoff, a game that they always struggle with. I don't think that that's going to be the outcome, and I know that there are a lot of my favoritism toward Yale. Favoritism is not the right word, but my kind treatment of Yale, my early adoption of Yale being good, I think is well documented. But the Yaleys listening know that this is a game that they've struggled with in the past.
If I had to pick a runner-up, I would I'd throw the Harvard Brown game out there. I wouldn't be shocked if Harvard wins that game at Harvard against a Brown team that is steamrolling opponents. You know, is Jahelka back?
We don't know.
Yeah. But that would be my second upset special if I had to pick one. But the favorites, you know, they're in the top five for a reason.
No doubt.
Terry, it's time for our final segment of the afternoon. New words to live by. You know, last week, Terry's Twitter handle, I think, at Terrence Foy, and I'm at D_Fly. But Terry has a thing. He's a man of words, and he's always looking for new words to live by. And I think you have found something.
I most recently found some in an Applebee's commercial.
Yeah.
I actually don't even know whether it was
the great American philosopher
Littrell Spiro.
Littrell Spree said, "Success is just failure that hasn't happened yet." Let that sink in. Success is just failure that hasn't happened yet. Said the man who choked out his coach, PJ Carlesima. And with that, we leave you. Thanks for listening, as always, and enjoy the games. We'll see you next week.